the Center for the Study and Teaching of Writing at The Ohio State University. This is Writer's Talk. I'm Doug Dangler. Michelle Herman's novel, Missing, won the Harold U. Raballo Prize for Best Jewish Fiction. Her other works include A New and Glorious Life, Dog, and The Middle of Everything, Memoirs of Motherhood. Her honors and awards included a National Endowment for the Arts Fellowship, a James Michener Fellowship, Artists Fellowships from the Ohio Arts Council and the Greater Columbus Arts Council, and the OSU University Distinguished Teaching Award and the Rodica Bottoman Award for Distinguished Undergraduate Teaching and Mentorship. Welcome to Writer's Talk.
Hey, Doug.
There's a bit of a downfall after all that, isn't there? You got to say, hey, Doug, hey, Doug. So anyway, your novel, your novella, Dog, I think that's your most recent one, right? Focuses on a university professor teaching fiction writing.
No, she teaches poetry.
Poetry. Sorry. Poetry.
She's nothing like me.
She's not. She's at a Midwestern university, so she's nothing like you. Okay. Tell me about the intersection for you between fiction and nonfiction as someone who's going out to write some. When do you decide when it's fiction, whether it's nonfiction, what's it going to be? You've written both.
Yeah. You know, I used to ask that question a lot myself of people who wrote both, and I never understood why they couldn't give me a good answer. And Now I have joined their ranks because the answer is so abstract. I really never think, oh, should this be fiction or should it be nonfiction? Mm-hmm. And I'm only half joking when I say that the character in Dog is nothing like me. I think of Dog as the there but for the grace of God version of my life. Mm-hmm. The character and I have certain things in common. I've given her certain of my bits and pieces of my childhood, certain teachers. She grew up in New York City too, although in a different part of New York. If you're from New York, the idea of Brooklyn versus Flushing is like, you know, the difference between Oklahoma and Texas, let's say, if you're from that part of the country. But she's a middle-aged woman who's a writer and teaches in a large, unnamed Midwestern university who never married, never had children, and whose life is devoted to her dog, which could easily have happened to me. But in fact, that is not the path my life took. So it wasn't as if I thought, oh, am I going to write a story about me and my dog? Mm-hmm. It was a moment where I thought, oh, what would it be like if I had gone this way rather than this way. And that's often where fiction begins for me, is what would it be like if, mm-hmm. whether it starts with someone like me or someone completely different from me.
Well, it sounds like the old, I took one creative writing class, A-. And my wife got an A. Not that I'm bitter all these years later.
Were you in class together?
We were in class together, right, yes. Anyway, the old adage of write what you know. And that comes back to things like this, but where does it end?
I like just to write some of what you know. I mean, you can't really. I don't think you can write something. I don't think you can write fiction if you don't understand what the feelings are like, you know, that the character is experiencing. Mm-hmm. But you know, I did not have to turn out to be a single person in middle age in order to be able to write that. Obviously, I've been fiddling around now with a new, who knows, long story novella that's about a young magician. And I don't know anything about what it would be like to be a young magician. I had a magician as a student once, and I was kind of captured by the idea of it. And, of course, as I go on with his story, more and more of his life becomes more familiar to me. Suddenly it turns out he was brought up in New York, and his father was a novelist. You know, so I'm writing what I know, but if you only write what you know in fiction, the fiction becomes pretty dull to you. You know, writing it pretty quickly.
Mm-hmm. You said it's either a long story or a novella. What's the difference? What are the conventions that separate one from the other?
There are so many different conventions for this. Some of it, people talk about it in terms of page length, but then by the page length or the word length definitions, The Great Gatsby would be a novella, and no one thinks of it as a novella. So it's some combination of how long things are and what the scope is, it seems to me. My first book was called a novel, and it was a novella, Missing. Mm-hmm. It was, I don't know, maybe a 200-page book, but it covers a very short span of time. It's very focused around one character. Everyone else is really peripheral, and I felt very certain that what I had written was a novella. So some of these names are marketing decisions.
You felt certain, but somebody else.
Yeah, the publisher said we're going to call it a novel because you cannot sell something and call it a novella. People, unless it's by a very famous writer, people are not going to spend money for a hardcover book that's called a novella. Actually, Dog was a novella. And at the very last minute, the publisher said, you know, let's call it a short novel. They couldn't really call it a novel because it's so short. It was in manuscript. It was maybe 125 pages or 150 pages. I forget. It's a very small book with very large print. So they knew they couldn't call it a novel, but they didn't want to call it a novella. And that was their compromise. And again, it's totally a marketing thing. For me, the novella length, which is probably somewhere between, I mean, you know, where does the long story, a short story, once you get to 30 pages, it's not a short story anymore. Once you get to 75 pages, it's not really a long story anymore, in terms of practical. And I don't know, this story about the magician, given my tendencies, will probably come in at closer to 100 to 150 pages, which will make it a novella.
Mm-hmm. Now, you said, given your tendencies, why are your tendencies towards short as opposed to really like the full-length novel? What is it that attracts you to the shorter form, to the shorter
stories? It's a very good question. I wish I had a smart answer to that. It's not so much that I want to write novels. Because I teach short story writing, I keep trying to write short stories, which grow into long stories and novellas. I don't think it's a coincidence that when I write essays, literary essays, creative nonfiction, whatever you want to call it, they also tend to run toward a peculiar length, somewhere between 75 and 200 pages, which is not a book-length work of nonfiction, nor is it, by any stretch of the imagination, an essay. I could call it an extended essay. That's a terrible phrase. So I usually call them novella-length essays. For a while, I flirted with memorella. But,
memorella.
Dessert, right?
Right, yeah, or a Disney character.
Yeah, so, it's a length that is, if you ask my literary agent, she would say that it's pure contrariness on my part because it's the most unmarketable length that it is possible to write. It's too long for a magazine, too short for a book.
You put two of them together, though.
Or many of them together as
collections.
I mean, essentially, the middle of everything was three novella-length essays and one long essay. And my new manuscript is three novella-length essays and a large number of long essays. It's a big, fat book.
Why do you think that there's a marketing... why do you think people are less likely to buy, it sounds like, a collection of these than a full novel?
I wish I knew the answer to that question. I mean, all I can tell you is it's not people who are less likely to buy. It's publishers who are convinced that people are less likely to buy. I don't know if that's true or not. Mm-hmm. People are unlikely to buy any work of literature, frankly. You know, I mean, seriously, a new work of literature of any kind, unless it's something that either for some reason just takes off hugely. Generally by word of mouth. I don't think reviews make much of a difference. Or that has the full weight of the publishing industry's marketing machine behind it. A new novel, collection of stories, memoir will sell about 5,000 copies, which seems like a lot of copies to me. Mm-hmm. And then libraries will buy it. Plenty of people will read it. Publishers are very shy about calling something essays. Mm-hmm. Or taking on a collection of stories unless that writer is already working on a novel. Mm-hmm. I think it's habit. More than anything.
Okay. Let's follow that through, because if you talk about habit, you're talking about the way that marketing is now. It seems to me that all that is in the process of changing. You're looking, you've got downloadable stuff, all the e-readers. Does that seem to you to be something that do you talk about it with your students? Does it seem that the horizons are really changing for what's going to happen, that reading habits will change? Is there any evidence towards that?
I'm not sure that there's real evidence yet, or if there is, that anyone's keeping track of it. I think the publishing industry is a peculiar kind of industry, because it was founded by gentlemen with money to spare who wanted to do something intellectual and artistic with their time. And, of course, now it's essentially a business. But it's a business that's in the business of selling something that no one actually needs. It's not like the business of selling shampoo. Nor is it dealt with strictly as art. And I think the publishing industry kind of lags behind whatever it is that readers are interested in doing. this whole mess about electronic rights, which is not getting resolved neatly or, you know, cleanly and smoothly as you would think it would in any other kind of industry, mm-hmm. I think indicates that. My guess is if publishers could figure out what this means, then a lot of their old prejudices would probably wear away. I mean, it seems to me on the face of it that publishers would be thrilled to take collections of stories because people mm-hmm. can read stories quickly. You can read one, you know, when you're on the subway commuting. If people are going to have things read out loud to them while they're driving, then what difference does it make? I don't entirely understand it. I know that the prejudices against certain forms of literature run very deep. Mm-hmm. If my agent were here, no doubt she would go on and on about why. She'd be pounding her, you know, her shoe on the table. It's very mysterious to me. It really is. Maybe mm-hmm. the word essay just sounds like something from school. And if we only had a new, and maybe short story sound. I mean, look at poetry. Nobody wants to publish poetry. No, mm-hmm. you know, very few commercial publishers are interested in publishing poetry at all.
But those are the shortest things. I mean, those are the easiest to read in a compressed time.
Not to get meaning from, but certainly to digest.
It seems to me,
and especially given electronic readers, where you can, you know, you can play with it, you can highlight things, you can look words up so easily. You would think that poetry could actually have a kind of publishing resurgence. Mm-hmm. But I actually think that what goes on in publishers' minds and what readers really might be yearning for is going to take a long time before those two things connect.
So when you're teaching at OSU and you have a student that comes up to you and says, I've got this piece, but it can only be on a screen.
Right.
What's your reaction to that? How often
It's happening more and more. Let's sit down together and figure out what you can do with it. There are more and more literary magazines that are fooling around with this sort of thing.
Fooling around?
Yeah.
that doesn't suggest anything.
Well, no one has done it. I mean, frankly, you know, you write a short story or a literary essay or a poem, and the chances of getting paid anything for it are fairly small. Mm-hmm. It's astounding, actually, that let's put quotes around industry, that there's this entire industry of writers working hard at their work and sending out stories and essays and poems, and you know, if they're lucky, getting paid $500 mm-hmm. for it. So fooling around is, you know, that's where it's going to begin. It's going to have to begin at the level of literary magazines that are playing with it. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it'll be in our lifetime that real publishers, you know, publishers mm-hmm. that have money to spend, will have any idea what to do.
I think it was Michael Joyce who did Afternoon? It was a hypertext story that you would drop into at different times. Is anybody still doing stuff like that? Do they do that at OSU? Or?
No, we don't do it at OSU, and I have no idea if anyone is still doing it. It's funny. I keep thinking about it, too, because I have one of my absurdly long recent essays has songs in it, and I like to give readings from it. I originally conceived of it as a sort of one-woman show, but of course it turned out to be too long. It would take 4 hours for anyone to sit through this one-woman show. But I keep thinking that rather than publish this essay as part of a book, it is part of my book manuscript, it would be so much more fun for it to be available in some other form mm-hmm. where I could be singing. I mean, the essay is part, it's part autobiography, memoir, it's part musical theater history and criticism. It's part singing lesson because I've been taking singing lessons for the last 5 years and I want to share what I have learned about how to breathe. And it's just part song. I mean, I periodically lapse into or leap into song. So I know the full experience is not going to be gained when you sit there reading it. Mm-hmm. But no one has suggested that we do anything more unusual with it than just put it in the pages of a book.
Well, it's funny because then you, as an instructor, having to say, all right, we've got our students over here. We're teaching them how to write. But we also need to teach them about digital media. We also need to teach them about rights. You know, what happens, like the songs.
I don't try to teach them anything about that. I figure I learned the hard way that there were a lot of songs. You see, when you write things with song lyrics in them, for example, in poems or essays or short stories and publish them in literary magazines, since there's no money involved, nobody cares. Mm-hmm. No one worries about it. As soon as you publish with a commercial publisher, or even in the case of the middle of everything, a savvy university press publisher, they worry about rights. And they threw it on me to do, and so I had to teach myself. I had a crash course. Mm-hmm. And very quickly removed the epigraph from the book, which was from a Beatles song, and because it was going to cost me $500, and I was not going to spend $500 for one line from a song. But I did go through the book, and I did. I spent $125 to secure the rights to the words, and by me, that's only great, from the song I Enjoy Being a Girl.
Okay.
Fair use is a very
really one line is $125.
Yeah. When it comes to song lyrics, there appears to be no fair use, as far as I can tell. Huh. I paid for every song lyric that I quoted in that book, and it didn't stop me. I swore I'd never put song lyrics in anything again, and now I've got this essay that's filled with them. And I figure I know what happens by now. And that's what I tell my students: don't worry about it. When you sell the book, your publisher you'll negotiate with your publisher about what to do about it. Chances are you'll be responsible for paying for the rights, and you can decide then if you want to cut them out. I paraphrased a bunch of them. A lot of Beatles songs were very expensive. I ended up paraphrasing large numbers of...
So, She Loves You, Yes, 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 things like that?
No, it was more like, instead of quoting a line from a George Harrison song, you know, George Harrison sang a song about relaxing your mind, you know. It actually turned out to work better in most cases, which is usually what happens when you have to go back in and fiddle with something you've written.
So revision good is what
revision
you're getting.
Revision always good. Yeah.
But not the revision where you would have to pare down the four-hour thing into the 2 hours for the one-person show.
You know, I was
show.
Saying just today to an old student of mine, I would be glad to go back into that manuscript and cut it down, but not until someone says, I'm going to pay you for it. I already put 2 years of my life into writing that book. Mm-hmm. And as soon as someone is, I don't need an editor to do it for me. I can do it, but I don't want to go back and do it for nothing. I wrote the book I wanted to write. I'm very happy with that book. Mm-hmm.
Now, you've mentioned your agent a couple of times.
She's one of my best friends. So I just saw her, too, so she's on my mind.
Okay, different question. No, you're talking about agents and editors and things like that, and I'm wondering what kind of relationship is now existing between authors and agents and editors, actually.
Right.
Has this changed a lot? Because it seems to me that books are moving more quickly from a manuscript stage into a published stage because you've got all the electronic flow that is much easier to do. And so there may be less influence. I mean, I look at
that
somebody
like...
That would
be such a wonderful... If that were the reason, that would be such a good reason. But in fact, the reason that editors and writers have much less of a relationship than they used to is the publishing industry has, two things have happened. They've trimmed down so much. So many people have just, you know, have lost their jobs.
Right.
And so they're functioning on skeleton staffs. So every editor is, and they haven't, you know, reduced the number of writers they're working with. So every editor is now handling many more books at the same time. So that's one thing that's happening. So they simply don't have the time to spend. The other thing that's happening is that, and this was happening long before they started laying editors off, the publishing industry became more about selling books than it became about making wonderful books. And so editors were spending tinier and tinier portions of their time actually doing what, you know, what Maxwell Perkins did with Tom Wolfe. Today, there is, I don't think it's unfair to say that there is probably no editor who can take on a book that needs a lot of work, just none. There are still a few who will take on a book by a well-established writer that needs some work. But I think MFA programs have taken over the role now of what editors used to do. I mean, our students, when they finish something, it's much more finished, I think, than it used to be in the old days.
Mm-hmm. That's funny because I've heard, like, the music industry, for example, say, okay, the ones that we put out all this R&D on all these groups to bring them up, which is sort of, you know, revision editing, but we make our money, and all of that is floated by the really big sellers. But in the publishing industry, you've got some really big sellers. You know, there are people writing vampire novels.
Right.
There are Stephen King. You know, they've got these people knocking it out of the park. But what happens to all that money?
It goes into the next huge advance for the next. I mean, it really is. It's a system that makes no sense whatsoever. Because there's still, you would think that given all the stuff that's been happening over the last few years, they wouldn't do it anymore. They're still coughing up these enormous advances that cannot possibly pay out. There's just no way, you know. They find a writer and they want, because it's a prestige item, because it makes for a great news story, to pay a huge advance, and the book doesn't sell enough copies to make that. The book can sell tons of copies, but it's not going to make that advance back out. So no, the money tends not to float down. I think there was a time again when that happened to some extent, but no.
Okay.
Alas, no.
Well, let's look at the other end of it then
and
talk about one of the things that you do, one of the hats that you wear, is a co-editor, if I'm right, on the journal, the OSU's literary publication. And, you know, I have to tell you, the name of this causes me a great deal of difficulty when I have to talk about it, because I can't call it OSU's Literary Journal.
I know.
So I'm
we
sure
inherited
you're familiar
this name. And actually, when Kathy Fagan, the poet I work with, and I inherited the magazine, at first we thought it would be funny to do the cover as one of those black and white generic. It used to be in the supermarket, there'd be a whole row. They don't exist anymore, a whole row of generic products that had no packaging at all, everything. Mm-hmm. But that was not such a good idea. We thought about changing the name, too. But, it, you know, the magazine has now been around for about 40 years. So it was originally The Ohio Journal, but it got confused with The Ohio Review, which also doesn't even exist anymore at Ohio University. Mm-hmm.
Then that name's changed.
Well, actually, the New Ohio Review started publishing a couple of years ago.
Okay.
And they go by NOR, just to make things more complicated.
Oh, okay.
But we're used to the Journal now. And the Journal is one of those magazines that I was talking about, right? It's one of the literary magazines that, you know, we have no trouble finding wonderful work to publish. We get many more submissions than we can possibly publish. And, you know, we can only afford to pay writers maybe $25 for what they've done.
Well, tell me about the submission process for something like this. If somebody wants to get something to you, they send it in, it goes into probably the slush pile.
The slush pile, the famous slush pile, which means manuscripts that we haven't asked for, unsolicited manuscripts. Kathy and I each have gangs of both MFA student and advanced undergraduates who've taken a literary publishing class with us and taken creative writing classes, who go through the manuscripts. And they're read by several different student readers, and they write readers' reports, and they pass them around and talk about them. And the best of them make their way to an associate editor who is an MFA student in creative writing at Ohio State, working in the genre, who will make a decision about whether to pass the work on to me or Kathy, depending on the genre. So things get winnowed from this to this to this. And each new editor who comes on to work with me always starts out giving me a bunch of stuff to read, and then fewer and fewer things as they figure out what it is I'm interested in. Because the magazine does, you know, bear my stamp. So it's not – so, you know, editors will sometimes say, we just want to publish good writing. And, of course, we just want to publish good writing. But, you know, you also only want to publish what you enjoy yourself. And there are lots of things that I don't enjoy stories that have violence in them, for example. So I would pass on a story that was violent, no matter how beautifully written. I'm just not interested.
Okay. And you also direct the Graduate Interdisciplinary Specialization in Fine Arts.
That's a mouthful.
That's a long name.
We call it GISFA.
GISFA.
Yes.
All right. So this is for students at OSU who are interested in fine arts. And I always have sort of a funny reaction. Oh, there's a fine arts. And
as opposed to the course arts.
Right. So tell me about that. How does somebody
It helps if I tell you that its original title was the Graduate Interdisciplinary Specialization in the Making of Art. But a faculty member in the dance department, who's no longer in the dance department, objected to that title. So I changed it to a title that no one could object to. But that really is what the specialization is about. And it's a program. It basically just formalized what a lot of graduate students were already doing. An awful lot of people come to graduate school to do creative writing or glass blowing or painting or dance. Or music, but they're interested in other arts as well. And most artists actually do practice at least one other art, sometimes semi-secretly. And so they were finding ways to take courses in these other art fields. Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to formalize it. I wanted to have an advising system for them. I wanted them to have some designation on their transcript that they'd done this. And so anyone who comes to OSU, as long as you've been admitted to a graduate program that has an audition process or a portfolio process or a writing sample process, is welcome to pursue this. All they have to do is come see me, and they are automatically enrolled in it.
Does that let them take other courses, more courses outside their major than they ordinarily
do? Yeah, actually they do. It's a program of courses. They take, there's a core course, which is a seminar. I'll be teaching it this coming spring. And we take turns among us as a group of faculty in the various arts who teach it. That really is an interdisciplinary seminar where we have choreographers and painters and poets and nonfiction writers and glassblowers and actors. And they bring their work to the table, and it's a very different kind of critique process than you would get if you're only working within your own group.
How does it impact the writers that go through that when they have to critique or are critiqued by somebody wholly in a different area?
I actually think it It does change things. I mean, first of all, some collaborations inevitably result, and some romances. But I think...
Is that in the advertisement for it? Collaborations,
I think that... particularly when you're accustomed to going through, for example, the writing workshop, and there's the jargon of the writing workshop and the expectations of the writing workshop, it's eye-opening to sit down with a group of other artists who are not going to ask those same questions, who are not going to say, have you earned this ending, for example, who are going to say, you know, how did you know when this poem was done? You know, which is a question that makes as much sense for the abstract painter as it does for the composer, as it does for the poet. And so because you're thinking about your work in a different way and you're being asked questions, you know, by other people who are also experts in what they do. I don't know if I could quantify the way it changes it. And not everyone is interested in it, obviously. Mm-hmm. There are people who think of it as formalized dilettantism and who will argue and have argued with me that graduate school is a time to specialize, not to expand. I think differently.
And well, this is sort of an add-on, though. I mean, they're going to get a different degree.
They have their MFA in creative writing, and then they will have, it's just designated on their transcript that they've completed this interdisciplinary specialization. And I work with them to pick the courses. They take the core course, and then they take at least three other courses, in art field other than their own field.
So they take three separate ones, but I'm curious if you notice a theme, like do MFAs tend to take... like a lot of them like to take glass blowing, or is this something you mentioned?
No, it's really, I mean, I had a photography student who did her entire interdisciplinary specialization in music production. Mm-hmm. And there are people who do a little of everything. There are people who think they're going to focus on something and end up doing something. You know, they take one drawing class and then they discover, you know, they really want to draw.
They could do all their own on their books and get paid twice.
There you go. Yeah, sure. Get paid nothing twice. I'm very cynical about this these days.
All right. Well, Michelle Herman, thank you very much for talking to us today on Writer's Talk.
It was fun.
And from the Center for the Study and Teaching of Writing at The Ohio State University, this is Doug Dangler saying, keep writing.